Welcome, everybody.
Hip hop's finest hour on the radio. Today, we've got guest appearance by Al Pacino. We'll get to that shortly. Make sure to go on outthegutter.com and purchase that one of those 1,000 physical copies of the greatest hits, because once they're gone, they are going to be gone. And they're selling fast. So make sure to get one. They're rare. Like I said before, they'll never be made again. Ever. Only 1,000. All right. Get Al Pacino. Let's go.
Danny Collins, terrific cast.
Oh, I never saw that. Yeah, what a cast.
When you see that montage, what do you think about this career in acting that you have had and continue to have?
It baffles me. You spend your life just moving on, you know, and it's one of the perks, but also one of the issues you have when you're with a group of people and you're with them and you're in a company, and you know, we all sort of feel that way. Actors are, they're transient, you know.
Yes.
And
somebody once said gypsies. All actors are gypsies.
They are. They have that in their spirit. It's so when I look at things I've done before, there is a certain, mercifully, there's a distance you have, and you look at it and say, it's all part of, if you want to call it development, or you want to even call them. I remember Kazan, they had a special evening for Kazan, and they showed all the movies he did, and he got up on the stage and he said, "Wow, why? How am I still walking around? How did this happen?"
Yes, yes.
I know, I remember once they did one for me, actually, and I went up there and thought, you know, there's no rehab in this. Where's the time I was in rehab? I never was in rehab, you know.
But the question posed in John Lennon's letter in Danny Collins, stay true to yourself. You've stayed true to yourself for the most part, haven't you?
Well, I guess so. Here and there, I've veered off, I think. I don't know. I don't make those think of myself as that at all, that I'm being true to myself. I can feel when I'm not. I can feel when I've gone off the track.
Personal life or in the performance?
In both. More in the performance than personal life. Personal life's a little bit too random for me, and the way and how. I mean, I'm playing characters who've lived these lives all over the world and stuff, and gone through, you know, the accessibility of things in our life, in our world, you know, that you travel in. So,
do you keep saying yes to parts? I mean, you've got these two movies coming out.
I don't get
others.
It.
You keep saying yes, and yet there are these questions you say, when I see him making a movie, I want to walk the other way.
That's true, I do. I think I've gotten out of something when I'm finished with it. And when I see, I'm on the street and I see people, the campers, and they've got the wires on the floor and the cameras, I just go to the other side, because I feel as though I know what they're going through. I know it's different when you direct a movie, because you're in every part of it. And it's also different for an actor as you prepare for a movie, because there's the rehearsal period, which we don't have enough of in films today.
Right.
But the old Sidney Lumet movies, early on movies I did in the 70s, we had really substantial rehearsal periods to develop characters and relationships with other actors in it. Here you're just... So in this movie, we had no rehearsal in Danny Collins. So we would meet...
Because of the budget?
Yeah. That's what it is. It's the budget.
Yes.
It's the budget is what we're always facing. And we would rehearse in my house on weekends to get what we could in, because it's...
But why do you do it? Because you love it? Because it is who you are? It is... I once said to a fighter, I said, why do you do it? You've made all the money in the world. You have a great family. You have all the things that anybody would aspire to.
Mm-hmm.
International fame. what I do. Mm-hmm. It's what I do.
Yeah.
I'm a fighter. Yeah. And you'd say, I'm an actor. That's what
yeah.
I do.
It's funny. You have the text. You see, I live by the text. Yeah. The play is the thing, you know, the Shakespeare. And when I see that text, I don't want to act, for instance. I don't want to do it. I mean, I don't want
to sit down. You don't need to be in movies.
I don't need it. I really, yeah. I don't think I need it until I read it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, some, and of course the process, and it's forever changing because, you know, there's a time when you want to do something because it challenges you and you feel you'll learn something from it, so you do it and you can fall flat on your face and the results of that. But mostly you're trying to evaluate things in your life and deal with the very, I have children and things, I, you know, things come up. And but at the same time, that's that script, you know, I read a script the other day. I won't say what it is, but I hadn't read anything, and I'm like, oh, they pull me back in,
yeah,
kind of
thing. Yeah. Because you think about what I could do with this character. You think about the excitement of getting inside of the character.
It's the world the writer creates. It's yeah. the text. It's, oh, what an opportunity. You know, I have an opportunity to do this again or for the first time. There's something about the, almost this thing is what I do, like you said, it's an almost an obligation
yeah.
to get involved in it, I feel.
That this is for you.
This is for
I
me.
Can, as they say in business, add value to this.
Yes. Or I can find something in a thing that I'm doing that relates to something inside of me that I've been wanting to express or talk about in some way. It's a form of speaking to mm-hmm. acting. When I first started, I think what kept me an actor was when I realized that I could speak through this venue mm-hmm. and that I could speak about things in life that I couldn't speak about before. I just didn't know how. I couldn't find the words. But the playwright allowed me to express something.
It's the coming together of the actor and the text. The
That's
actor
right.
and the words
That's
give
right.
you the possibility to make it something bigger than even the
That's
writer
right.
intended. That's what an actor adds. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And to move on from a life you know to a life you may not know and find out about it and get a sense that you're involved in something that's bigger than your life.
Mm-hmm. The Humbling, Philip Roth 2009
yeah.
novel.
Yeah.
You liked it.
I liked it, yes.
What attracted you to it in terms of, as an actor, did you see there things that you have thought about? Things that...
Well, yeah, I thought that with...
Losing your skills, in a sense.
Well, I
how
guess...
How did you see it?
Well, I saw it as a potential movie at a certain point in life. You know, there's certain things you can't do anymore. You know, your age
sure.
comes in and you're trying to find something that's suitable, is appropriate.
That happens to everybody.
Yeah, I hope.
Yes,
but
it does. I mean, I see people every day who
yeah.
are athletes or
oh, well, the athletes more is more obvious
yeah,
because
obvious,
they,
yeah,
or the actor
obvious,
they
yeah.
have the yeah. you know the grandfather's
but
slot.
The interesting yeah. thing about acting is that, you know, it's a bit like people who say you shouldn't read certain Tolstoy until you're 30 but
yeah.
you don't fully understand it.
They say you shouldn't do Hamlet till you're at
exactly.
least 40, except you got to do Hamlet earlier because you won't do it if you wait till 40. You'll learn too much. You know it's impossible. So the best thing is to get in there. So I love when the young actors do it. You know, I didn't do it. I never felt I was right for Hamlet. I didn't. I loved the play. It's probably my favorite play of all of Shakespeare.
And you never did it.
I never did it. I did scenes from it. I just didn't feel I could exist in that play in a way. I thought, like other people have, that when I get older, I'll understand it more. There's a question of understanding it as an audience and understanding it as an artist. Yeah. And that's the separation for me.
Was it Ella Kazan that had you want to do a reading? It was Hamlet and somebody. I forgot.
That's Strasberg.
That was Strasberg.
Yeah.
It was Strasberg.
Yeah, yeah.
What was it?
Well, I did two. I was afraid to do anything. I was very young. I got into the actor's studio at a very young age. And I just sat around there and watched them. And then I would go home. But throughout my life, I had learned, I committed to memory certain monologues that I liked.
Now, you were almost a teenager then, weren't you?
I was my early 20s.
Early 20s.
And so I thought, gee, I've got these monologues in me, this great Eugene O'Neill monologue from The Iceman Cometh.
Exactly, Iceman is what it was.
And I had the wonderful rogue, what a rogue and peasant slave am I, you know, from Shakespeare's Hamlet. And I had them committed to my mind. And so I went up. For the first time, I was sitting there 6 months.
Yes.
Finally, I got up the nerve to sign up for the... And Lee Strasberg looks at the paper and says, I love that he was able to pronounce my name, Al Pacino. Most people say Pacini, Pacani, you know.
Right.
I grew up with that in school and stuff. And so he said, Al Pacino, yes. What's this? Hamlet and the Iceman Cometh. Okay. Well, let's see him, you know. He says, you know, we take all kinds in here. So I got up there and I did a ferocious rogue and peasant, and then I went wild with Eugene O'Neill.
Were you playing Hickey?
Hickey, yeah.
Right.
And I was really giving it the old gung-ho, you know, stepping on the gas and stuff. Wasn't really that good. And it was over, and he was looking at me, and the audience got kind of cheery about it because it had a lot of commitment and energy, and I was young. And he just said, listen, Al, here's what I'd like you to do immediately. This was the genius with him. He said, I want you to do Hamlet as Hickey from The Iceman Cometh. And Hickey as Hamlet. And what I did is immediately went into it. And he was very happy about that. I didn't pause and say, well, what do you mean? I just switched it.
Had the character of Hamlet and the text of Hickey.
Yes. And then the text of Hamlet and
the
Hickey
character
as
of
Hamlet.
Hickey as the
as
presence
Hamlet.
He had.
Yeah. Yeah. I learned more that day than I have my entire life.
The first line of Philip's book is called, He Lost His Magic. I mean, do you fear that?
Oh, my. Well, you can imagine. To know that as you get older, too, the stamina to do, especially what this character does in Humbling, he does theater. So, you know, that's an eight performances a week job doing these enormous roles. I don't know if you ever saw the movie The Dresser.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Well, you see, they don't even know what character they're playing that now. They did three a day, you know. So we do one a day. However, the exhaustion and the tools you have as an actor, which is your own energy, your own appetite, because I don't think you get up there and do King Lear if you don't have an appetite. It's just impossible to do. There's certain things we can do if we don't feel like it. But you have to find it somewhere.
Yeah.
You can't do Lear. No. You can't, like, walk through it. Maybe if you're doing a movie of it, it's possible.
Yeah.
But
not in one sustained performance.
No, you can't.
Do you want to do Lear?
No, not particularly.
Not yet or not
yet? No, there's another one that I've actually been having offers to do it all the time as a movie. I could see myself possibly doing it one day as a movie. Possibly, because it's great, of course, and it's got. But I haven't found my way to Lear, and I don't think it's my role.
Yeah, but you love Richard.
I love Richard. Richard, I could possibly do again. I did a reading of it. Actually, I was at the Philadelphia Philharmonic.
Yes.
I was hosting, believe it or not, the 158th anniversary of the theater there. It was a wonderful thing with a great orchestra, and I was the MC of the thing. I don't know how that happened, but
it's not easy.
You know, I don't know. And I found myself doing it, and was really mainly talking about the first time I heard serious music or classical music. Was it? Remember the old Lewison Stadium here?
Oh, yeah,
I'm
sure.
I heard Stravinsky, Rite of Spring. I was there when Stravinsky himself conducted it. and that was, we were talking about inspiring moments. Yeah. I'll never forget that. And we were talking about times we heard the music for the first time. And anyway, I did Richard. I did several poems by E. Cummings and stuff, with the music behind me.
Yeah.
This is a new experience. I loved it. I thought, maybe I should do this. Actors do. Chris Plummer does it from time to time. So I did Richard. And my great friend Charlie Lawton had told me, he passed on a couple of years ago, and before he and I were talking, he said, you know, Al, you should try Richard again. Mm-hmm. He says, I'm seeing things with you now. And so, and I said, yes, I wonder why he said that. Then I went to Philadelphia, and 2 years later, I'm up there doing Richard, and it was so different. It was so much a part of me, yeah, in a way. And I added something to a speech.
Richard hadn't changed. You'd changed.
I'd changed, yes. You know what I used to do with Richard when I was first did it in Boston? I was young, early 30s. This was me doing Richard. I'd be in a dressing room, and we were at I was in the rectory, because we did it in the church. Church of the Covenant was the only time we really got it a little bit. And it was in the midst of real turmoil in my life. I had just become a kind of movie star, and I was drinking, and I was in this state constantly. So before I would go on, and I'd come out of the pulpit, Mike, and I'd just say, now is the winter, over a microphone in this church.
Yes.
So,
now is the winter.
But I wouldn't go out. I would stay in the dressing room, which was in the rectory. And I had this girl, I won't mention her name, but she was a stocky girl, very young, an apprentice, was in, I think she was at Harvard. She was so smart and so much fun to be with, but she was just my assistant. And so I would be there in the rectory making up for Richard. And she would come in and say, it's five minutes, Al. 5 minutes. I say, well, it doesn't matter what it is. I'd say, this would happen every night. She'd say, what do you mean? I'd say, I'm not doing it. I said, I'm not doing it tonight. She said, oh, no, you have to do it. They're out. I said, no, you know, you know I'm not doing it. You're not going to make me do it. She says, I'm not going to make you. Oh, yes, I am. I'd say, stay away from me. She said, no, you're going on that stage. I'd say, stay away. I said, you do it. And we'd have this huge fight. And by the time all of a sudden I'd hear places, and I'd go off and do it. Now, that's preparation.
Yeah. So you were ready to go.
I was ready to go then.
Yeah.
I don't know what kind of preparation is that. I never heard of that. You know. But the point is, you get it when you can. It comes to you in the moment.
Yeah.
And
you have to find it?
Yeah. And I think, at least when you're doing, I would call the Richard I did at the Church of the Covenant, I would call that an inspired Richard. After that, I think the Richard I did was basically a lot of it by the numbers, a lot of it trying to remember what I had done before. Mm-hmm. And it didn't have the same flavor. It didn't have the same, it wasn't coming from the same place of expression, so to speak.
In inhabiting a character, do you have to find a hook for you? Do you have to find something about the character that I'm going to... You know, someone once said, I think it may have been Olivier, that when I put on the suit, mm-hmm, I know what the character is, mm-hmm, or something like that.
It does help.
But is there a thing that when you're unlocking the character, because you're going to inhabit the character, what do you look for? Anything other than what the text says to you?
Well, yeah, you look for that thing that moves you. I don't know what it is. I like repetition. There's a saying goes, repetition keeps me green.
Yes.
I love that saying.
Repetition keeps me green.
Keeps me green, because fresh.
Right.
Because the idea that we do performances over and over again, you would say, well, doesn't that get boring or stale? But no, it's in the repetition that the creation comes, that the expression comes. Because I'll give you an example. I was doing Richard once, and not particularly well, and this show was going on, and we couldn't get this court scene with a lot of people in it. I didn't understand what I was doing in the scene. So we would call rehearsals. We would rehearse it and stuff. And we would talk about it, think about it, you know, like all this kind of work where people together are trying to figure out something. And the 85th performance of Richard, I had on my 85th entrance, I knew the court scene. I understood it. I was there. I could play it.
But not in 84.
Not in 84. I might have been getting closer, didn't realize it.
Yeah.
I gave up the ghost, I guess. I just gave it up and said, oh, screw it. It's not going to happen, and I'll just keep going on. And I found it. So, you know, when Sam Levine, remember the great actor Sam Levine?
Yeah.
When I was watching The Royal Family once in the theater, and Sam Levine comes in, just opens the doors and comes in. And I was a young actor at the time, and I thought, wow. As soon as I saw that, I just said, wow.
That's an entrance.
It wasn't an entrance. It was something else. It was a gift. He was opening the doors to something spectacular with light in it and everything and energy and joy. And you know what it was?
What?
He's done it for 50 years.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
So that's a big thing. You know.
Did you ever use
put a
that
lot of
yourself
stock in
terms of any performance?
Well, sometimes the only thing I've done performances and they just got worse until they got better.
Because you're searching.
Here's the thing I did in American Buffalo once when I was doing it. I did it all over the world. And at first I remember people talking about, wow, you know, you go to Seattle and he's like a tiger. He struts back and forth and like a leopard in a cage or something. I thought that was very nice.
Yeah.
And probably that's what I was doing for a while. Then I no longer... After doing it for 4 years, on and off, I found myself in Boston at, I think it was the Curran Theater there, and we were doing this, or was it San Francisco? No, Boston, we were at the Wilbur.
Right.
That's right. And I came out, and I say the opening soliloquy in American Buffalo, beautifully written by David Mamet, it's just good. And I come in, the whole thing, and I'm doing the scene. I'm on stage for about 10 minutes. That's a long time, right? And I realized I hadn't moved. I hadn't moved from the spot. And so what happened is economy came.
Yeah.
That thing came. It wasn't there for years, and then it just came. That's what I mean about it.
But in a sense, some people say that the act of art is as in sculpture, is getting it down to a size. I mean, you are... It's taking a role or a painting, it is in a sense defining it down to where it works for you.
That's right.
You know, stripping away everything.
That's what
so
it
that
is.
What you see is the essence of a character, of a scene.
Mm-hmm. Hmm? You see it in sports.
In sports
a lot too.
Yeah.
You just see. You say he didn't do anything. Yeah. He didn't do anything. So of course it's what you go for. Finally,
you mentioned David Mamet. What is it about the two of you? Because you're going to be with him again in a new play.
Yeah, a new play is coming out in the fall. I don't know.
Does his words speak to you? Is it he has a sense of a character?
He understands. He presents a world in a way. And I think he and I just hear it. Like, for instance, we're colleagues on this play he's doing, collaborating. Of course, he's doing all the work, but I'm there, and you know, it's good to have someone, even for him, to bounce off and stuff. So I'm home thinking about something. So I see him there a few days later, a week later, and he's written down what I was thinking about.
Yeah.
So I think, okay, just go with that. Just go with that. Then
that's
I don't
what
know
writers
why.
Do, the power of observation.
Well, so it was just he's such a. You know, to call him a great writer is of course, it's a redundancy. But at the same time, he surprises me because he understands. You know, he was an actor, too. So, like, I believe Shakespeare was an actor.
Yeah. Merchant of Venice you love.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you've done that more than once.
Mm. I was in the movie.
I know.
And then I did the play.
I know.
And I knew what the great Dan Sullivan, the director, said, wanted me to play it. And I thought, yes, this is the time to play it because I learned about it in the movie a certain way and I took a tack on it because it's a movie. With theater, you can just explore more, I think. Movies, pretty much it's hard to explore.
You explore night after night too, can't you?
Yes, of course. But I knew that it would be a different Shylock. And so it was a great adventure for me to do that part. I really am very, very grateful.
Do you want to do Macbeth?
I've been told about that a lot, too.
No, this is...
I can't even mention the name, you know. You're not supposed to.
It's an old actress. It's a myth of the theater that you cannot mention the name.
Yeah. You know, I love the play, of course. Who wouldn't? But I don't know. I think that's another one that's been shelved for me. It's just great, but...
What else is on that list?
Well, I guess maybe doing Richard again, if the part where I wanted to play Iago for a long time in Othello, that's a part I wanted to play, and I was ready to play it.
You said wanted. Do you still want?
I want to play it. You see, the thing is, the cart is before the horse. Sometimes, you know, you just get it and you go. Yeah. To sit around wanting it, you know, in my off time for years, what I do is just, I mean, I practically know Iago. It's the longest written part in Shakespeare is Iago, believe it or not. And I know Hamlet, and I know these parts.
I know the words.
I know the text. Because
you practice it.
I practice it. Of course, everything changes when you get in the real, you know, it's like shadow boxing until you get in the ring. You know, it's a different story. I love the idea of driving a car. We used to hear Lee Strasberg would talk about it. It's like you're driving a car and everything's good. If you get in the car, you have no key. You didn't start it yet. But you do everything right. You know, you shift the thing, you do this. Everything's working. So I can do this. And then you put turn the key and the car goes. And pretty soon you're like, oh, man, what is this? And you're ducking cars and you're going on the sidewalk. And that's the difference between rehearsing alone and then getting in there with other people. But at least you get a familiarity with it. Because I love the plays. I love doing it. I love learning it. It's just fun to say some of those words.
I think you almost dropped out of high school, didn't you?
I did drop out of high school.
High school, yeah, to go act.
Actually, I went to work. I went to work because we needed money in my family.
It was
an economic necessity at the time. But I did go to the village age 17. And I did... I was really fed by all of that was going on in the 60s, and that I was all the coffee houses in the village and doing 16 shows a week of whatever play and passing the straw basket around. The audience would drop something and then we'd eat.
Like church revival.
So
Charles Loudon.
My friend.
Your friend. Yeah. What's the nature of the friendship?
Well, you could call it symbiotic, but at the same time, mentor to young.
How did it start?
When I was 17, and he was teaching over the Herbert Berghoff Studio.
Oh, yeah, HB Studios.
Studios, and I was there, and he was a student of Lee Strasberg, he was a student of Uta Hagen, and the great people. And I was there at kid, and a teenager, really.
Right.
And so anyway, I heard about him, but I took one look at this guy, and I knew... I came from that. There was a familiarity.
I want to talk about some of the things that you have done. I know you've talked about this before, but, I mean, when you did Dog Day Afternoon, did you know that you and Sidney had created something?
It's interesting, because when we were doing it, and I remember saying, because we rehearsed for a long time, as Charlie once said, well, you know, with this picture, just you pull the pin and let it go. Because as Sidney said to me, he says, it has its own life, Al. While we were shooting it, he says, it has a life of its own.
Yeah.
I thought, yeah, wow. I couldn't tell because I would be Marty Bregman very wisely because I was drinking in those days, too. I put a kind of an apartment under the bank.
Yeah.
And both me and Judith would be hitting on weed back down there. Judith Molina, she played my mother in it.
Yeah, right.
But they were all upstairs, and I was downstairs alone. And because Sidney moved. First of all, he had rehearsed for a month, so he just moved the actors along. It was all about pretty much about performance and stuff. But. When I would go up there and I was again in it, it absorbed me. But when I had to have a reshoot, I came back to the bank, and Sidney wanted me to reshoot because he sort of saw after the last shot that fellow that I was was channeling in some way, whatever that character was, evaporated. It just went out of me like that. It was gone. And then when I had to come back, I had to recreate something because we had to reshoot something. I couldn't get it.
Yeah.
I couldn't get it.
This is the idea, akin to the idea of how long does an actor take a part with him? I mean, does it stick with you for a week or a month or...
Well, when I was younger...
And once it evaporates, suppose you have to reshoot, can you recapture it?
Yeah. I think things have changed a little for me now. I think doing it so long now, I let it go relatively easy.
Just let it go.
Yeah, I just let it go. Yeah.
Not hard to do, just let it go.
I used to go back when I was younger, when I did Pablo Hummel.
Yeah.
I would go back, and when we were leaving Boston, I just went in the dressing room when I would leave the part, and I'd say, I'm going now, so I got to move on, you know, so I'm going to leave you here. Mm-hmm. And Hummel would say to me, I'm all right, I do all right. Yeah. That was a line from the play.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that was kind of the thing. I had to literally do that, but it does stick with you. Godfather stick with me for a while there. That part, that kind of place I had to go to, especially really the first two.
You didn't see him as a gangster, did you?
I never saw him as a gangster, no.
You saw him as?
I saw him as someone who inherited this thing and was there.
Did not want to expect to be there at an early time in his life.
No.
But then understood that it was his responsibility to family and to...
It was his destiny.
Destiny.
Yeah. And I always felt that about him. And I thought... He had certain ingredients that would allow him to do what he did, and his father saw that in him early on. And well, that's a long story with that one because I never wanted to play that part. It was Francis that got me to do it. He got me to do it. He wanted me to play that part.
Well, he fought for you too when they wanted to take you off.
Fought for me, completely fought for me, to such a degree it was like a. I kept saying, Francis, it's all right. I'll do other things, you know. I was afraid of the role, by the way, just for...
But some actors say that's good. It's when they're afraid of the role, that's the best thing that they can have. If they're not afraid of it, some tell me they don't really want to do the part. It has to scare them to be motivated to do it.
Well, that's certainly helped me with that. But when anyone sees you in a role... You go through a period when you become well-known or you become what is known as bankable. You start to find it's dubious because you don't know whether somebody wants you because they see you in the part or because you can bag the movie.
Office.
And you can get confused by that. So sometimes you do roles, but the best time is when a director wants you.
How well did you know Marlon Brando?
Well enough to love him. I didn't know him as well as other people have. I found him to be that kind of sensitivity where he can sort of feel you. He feels your stuff, and he gets very concerned. He was concerned about me because at the time there was so much controversy, and that I was going to.
This is after Godfather.
No, it was before, while we were shooting it.
He was concerned about you.
Because he came up to me once and just was doing my shoulders, just doing a little massage on my shoulders. Because he knew that I was going to go. I was a man that didn't have long left for the set. Because Francis wanted me, the studio didn't.
Right.
They didn't want Brando either. But then Brando, you know. But me, it didn't matter. They were just shocked that Francis
didn't Francis bring in, was it Picnic, was it Panic, or did he bring in?
Yeah, well, Jerry Schatzberg, who directed Panic in Needle Park, a beautiful movie. I don't know if you've ever seen
it. Oh, of course I did.
Oh, yeah. He
was a photographer, too, wasn't he?
Yeah. He's just a beautiful directorial.
But Francis brought them in?
He brought 8 minutes from A Panic in Needle Park.
Right.
And just showed it to them. And that got me in. And then I started, you know, there are scenes, you see, the part of Michael Corleone is sort of built. It's constructed in such a way that it starts almost like a kind of a shadow and turns into this presence. And that was the way I thought of finally getting to that, so that by the time you see him in the end, he is a kind of an enigma. And that's part of the power of him, because we don't know where he came from. So it has that feeling to it. It's almost missing.
Does it make you like two better than one? Godfather 2?
I like them both. I think one has its story. It's the original.
Right.
You know,
it's a book.
It's a great story. Two has Francis's story, I think.
Yeah.
He talks about himself in that movie, you know. And a lot of him is in it. A lot of his personal feelings he gets out and about himself and everything, and that's what gives it that that power.
I always wanted to ask you this. Brando became interested in this show, and he would watch it all the time. And he would call me up, and he would send me notes, and he would call himself Brandflakes.
I would
get a phone call.
I heard that.
What was his gift?
It's hard to define it. The genius of character,
right.
I guess. That's all I can say. I don't mean to be, but he had. But he did cross that line where he had the great beauty as a movie star,
right?
And he was a character actor, one of the few. You had Paul Muni before that. That was a character, great actor.
Right.
But never did you have a movie star. You had the great movie stars and the great actors, including Gary Cooper and Cary Grant. Right. They're wonderful. Wonderful to watch. But Marlon was a character actor. And that means that he played roles that were different from each other. Very distinctly different from each other.
And how have you managed to be a star to this day and not playing character roles as much as you're playing stars? Now, you're the center of these two films that you're in.
Well, again, I'm going by the...
Is it box office?
What I'm feeling.
Well, is it an identification? You tell me.
I think it's always been, you know, some movies I've made that are character-driven, different characters I play, I don't know. I find it, it's always it's a mystery to me. It really is a mystery. But I'm actually here talking to you and that I'm still doing this thing. But I started early too as an actor, and I was seen in New York in a play called The Indian Wants the Bronx, in which I was given
The Indian
Wants the Bronx.
Wants the Bronx.
In which I got an Obie Award for that year. And it was Faye Dunaway who saw me in this play and told Marty Bergman and CMA at
the great
time,
producer.
The great producer. And I made movies with him. But that play, there was something in that play that Israel Horovitz, beautiful play, The Indian Wants the Bronx, and John Cassell was in it too.
So,
with me, you know.
Yeah.
And I had been acting maybe 10 years before that, so I was quite young, my mid-20s, and it just started to sail along. And I did feel, oddly enough, when I talked about it, that I went from being this explorer in my work, in a way, experimenting and trying to learn more about the classics and myself in connection to it and doing things. I got a lot of joy out of that. I was in a place called the Actors Gallery down in Soho,
right,
which nobody could even find in those days, Soho. But as I said, the continuing in the Village and all, and then to finally be lauded in a way, and suddenly everything upped the stakes, and the star thing came in,
right,
and the name above the title came in,
yeah,
and somehow I was sort of trying to preserve something I thought I understood earlier on. Because I then found myself in another world, which I liked. I thought it was a good thing, and I still think it was a good thing. It was a lucky thing. Things happen that way sometimes. But maybe something happened that was somewhat new, a new kind of person that wasn't comparable to other things people were seeing. Came out of the 60s, came out of this time in America where people like me were, you know, being given an opportunity, whatever. I don't know. It was a combination of things. I remember one time I did a scene. Charlie was in class with me. We had this scene in the Berghoff studio. I'll never forget this, because Charlie, I saw him on his deathbed night, and I said to him, Charlie, remember the time when they were doing this big thing and I was one of the scenes in the school,
yeah,
and every teacher brought their student in that they wanted to show their work, how they were doing it. And I went into this thing, and I did this scene, I said, and I remember when I came to the scene, you, Charlie, grabbed me and just said, good stuff, Al, good stuff. And I said, oh. And then the teacher got up and went crazy against me, thought it was the worst, said, who do you think you are, Luther Adler? You come up here, you do this. And I was just sitting there thinking, what is this about? Mm-hmm. And I told Charlie in the hospital, I asked him, do you remember that time?
This is on his deathbed.
Yeah. I said, what was that? Why was he doing that? Why did he get so upset? He said, well, he said he saw a new time, a new era.
Yeah.
And I thought that in some way, I think it's very dramatic to hear that when Charlie says, I don't know that it's true, but I do know that it was interesting because that was happening. You know, it happens today too. Something new comes along, and it's either, we get used to it. You know, in the old days, actors had to be a certain, pronounce things a certain way and be a certain height so they'd be seen in the audience.
Right.
So there was I don't mean to compare myself with people like Edmund Kean, but I was always reading books about actors. I read about Edwin Booth, or I read about Edmund Kean. And Edmund Kean came at a time where, he came from a whole other climate, a whole other world. And when he went on the stage, it was new.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was something about the roles I played and the situation and the times we were in that connected. And I got lucky, really. And then it's been this thing all my life. And so I have to say it. I know you've heard it a lot. Everybody says it. But it's true. It's luck and timing. And I remember saying once to someone who said to me, Al, because we're all together, we're actors, I'm no better than anybody else is, and really in that way, because I've seen people do such great stuff, I wish I could do it. But at the same time, I remember this guy saying to me, Al, you're doing so well, these are a few years into it, right? He said, what is it? Why do you...
Why you?
Why you? I mean, why not me? He says, I always wanted this. I want this stuff that you have. I says, yeah. I said, you want it. I think I had to have it.
Oh, wow. Had to have it.
Had to have it. In a way, that's an interesting distinction, One doesn't know. I'm just mouthing now because I don't know. I just think that there was a period.
But you had to have it.
I had to have it. And believe it or not, I could tell when somebody... I knew at some point this was my time. I never thought it would turn into this naturally, of course it did. But I knew it was my time that I would be seen in some way, that enough had happened, and that this part in the Israel Harvest play. I went up to Boston. I did 2-3 plays there, repertory. I mean, I went to do a part in a play, and I there was no way. They all wanted me for this. They said, you're going to be great for this. And I thought, yeah, maybe I will be. But I got up and did it, and it was not good at all. As a matter of fact, I remember that I was in the dressing room, and somebody came down, and I heard it on the speaker. It was my entrance was coming up, and this guy in the dressing room was really excited by this review he was reading of the play we were doing. And I said, what's that? And he tried to cover it. I thought, well, why is he covering it? I said, can I see that, John? He said, yeah, okay, here. And he pushed it over to me, and I looked at it, and I saw this great review. And it was talking about this person, that person, how great, with the one exception. It was Al Pacino in the role of so-and-so. It was terrible. And I read that, and as I was reading it, my cue came on the speaker, and I had to go on stage. So I had to perform after reading that in the play he was criticizing me in. But I laughed. I think when you're a certain time, the ability to look at something like that and laugh, I think might have helped me a little bit. I don't know. It felt, it hurt. And another part that I didn't want to do, I was okay in. So it's always the question of, what do we do? I mean, you know, you're walking along the street, you see a certain tree, you either take a picture of it, or you get the canvas out and you paint it. You never know when it's going to happen. You read a script. And with actors, if you don't try it, you're not going to know. And what happens is if you start to censor yourself, I think when you start censoring yourself, it gets a little, because we don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, but you've been willing to take risk.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then you have to take risk.
You have to, I think. Yeah. Everybody, a lot of people do. You know, you have to finally take that risk. I took this risk with Danny Collins doing music, singing.
Yeah. Right. But no, you're singing in Danny Collins.
Yeah. Singing in the rain. Yeah. But it's okay. I hope I get by a little bit, but it's that I took it because the director really wanted me to do it. And when you think back, I took Godfather because the director really wanted me.
Francis wanted you.
He wanted me. That's what he saw.
Thank you for coming.
Back to the music.
Part, I want the whole enchilada. I just hit a lick like a lollipop. Left into the bank, funny bone, that's a lot of guac. Racks on racks on racks, I'm back. Still fresh from yesterday, more licks on the way. My girl just licked away, I put kids on her face. Mr. Duncan Hines, I put icing on the cake. Plotting half the day, how I'm about to get this mat today. Hot and scorching, falling in, I'm Jordan. Haters grill me like a foreman, cause I'd rather die enormous than live dormant. Me. Hitting licks, counting chips, my kingdom is for me. The top's so lonely, I'm free from the torment.
Y que por la puta mi nombre mencione. Tú siempre pichó en la mía, tranquilo. Si soy lo luyan que te engancha este rabo de oro en el cuello y ahora pa' su kilo. La muy siempre estelar. Si no me creo preguntar en el Banco Popular. Los topos de fútbol nunca de regular. Estoy hasta alguien que uno va a jugar. Dándome pa' lo que David Ortiz. Ando con los pibes locos dentro le tiro a Kiss. Me acostumbré a modelo con flow de París. Yeah. El más odio Donald Trump. Me aceite en el vapor ya no fumo un plon. Lo pongo a danzar duro como Tom. Me tocan y adelanto el Armagedón.
Jordan,
ballin' like I'm Jordan, ballin' like I'm Jordan, ballin' like I'm Jordan, ballin' like I'm Jordan, ballin' like I'm Jordan, ballin' like I'm Jordan.
Baby, give me that, give me that, give me that, give me that, give me that. Baby, give me that, give me that. To the CG, to the BB, to the U, double the L. I'm so hot, I'm hotter than hell. Now baby, turn around, from miserable to down. Went from the block to the yacht, to the G4, down the DR. Jet to the Detroit, not from Maryland. But when it comes to women, there can always be more. Get it, be more. Tupac, no, but I get around.
I'm Jordan. Ballin' like I'm Jordan, 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 ballin' like I'm Jordan.
This is for the ones in the broken homes. We have to get it on now. Dop on the beat.
Bandcamp.
Hypnotic. In the building. Let's get.
Getting lit at Lottie, getting lit at Lottie, getting lit at Lottie, every damn night. Getting lit at Lottie, getting lit at Lottie, getting lit at Lottie, every damn night. Getting lit at Lottie, it's the fucking vibe. Need to get here quick, like some shit or do or die. I got the whole entire menu memorized. You won't leave here without a glimmer in your eye. You ain't had it like this, you ain't had it this quick. You ain't had it this lit,
nope.
You ain't had it this live. Always a good time,
always.
And the bitch is too fine. Go ahead, shake it one time. Go ahead, shake it two times.
It,
she said, why you love Lottie? Told that bitch, it's my life.
She said, why you love Lottie? Told that bitch, it's my life.
Getting lit at Lottie. Getting lit at Lottie. Getting lit at Lottie. Every damn night. Getting lit at Lottie. Getting lit at Lottie. Getting lit at Lottie. Every damn night.
If you're not with it, you're missing out. Hypnotic on a mission now.
I count the money in dividends. I'm trying to stack it to the end. Fuck down the plate where I stay at. Yeah, that's home to me. Walking the bar and then roast to the third degree. Walking the bar, everybody getting lit. Walking the bar, got the baddest of bitches. Thank you for Lottie's, for saving my life. And I'm sorry for that one time I dropped all that Sprite. It happened. Walk in the room, got them clapping. Everybody loving all my anime.
Getting lit at Lottie's. Getting lit at Lottie's. Getting lit at Lottie's. Every damn night.
Getting lit at Lottie's. Getting lit at Lottie's. Getting lit at Lottie's. Every damn night.
Every damn night.
Every damn night.
Welcome back to the Hypnotic Show, hip-hop's finest hour on the radio. I want to thank Al Pacino for being a guest appearance today. And then tomorrow's guest appearance is Mark Zuckerberg. And then Sunday, the two-hour gospel special that I do every week. This week it's Joel Osteen. Don't want to miss it. And then also, anybody, make sure to buy my Glory to God CD. It's on outthegutter.com on my website. You can buy that there. Also, you can buy a bunch of my other limited edition shoes, glasses, everything. You know, I got all my autographed stuff there. That's signed too. Microphones and a bunch of stuff you can find on there. And then also make sure to get one of my greatest hits that's right on the cover. That greatest hits is only 1,000 copies that'll ever be made. And they're going quick, so make sure to get one before they're gone. Also, make sure to go on Money Talks Magazine. Go on Barnes & Noble to get the newest issue that I have my article for the Hypnotic Show on it. And it's the interview I did with Nas for the 50 year of hip-hop. So make sure to get that before they're gone. Also, anybody trying to hire me, you can hire me through Cameo. Go to Cameo.com, send a shout-out or something. Also, you could also go on K9Magazine.com, and you could get the issue, the July's issue with me and MJ on the cover, or you can go to K9Magazine.com/hypnotic to go directly to the interview. And then also, anybody that's trying to get something played on my station, just send it to hypnoticshow@outlook.com. Again, that's hypnoticshow@outlook.com. So make sure to do that. And then I will catch you guys tomorrow. Peace.